All right, let's dive into some fascinating legal history with this case. Corfield v. Coryell. We're talking oysters, states' rights, and what it meant to be a citizen in those early years of the U.S.
You know what's so interesting about this case? It kind of gets at this, like, fundamental question. Can states control their own resources, even if it means, you know, putting limits on access for people from other states?
Yeah, exactly. And the answer to that question, it has, like, ripple effects across so many areas of law, everything from interstate commerce to environmental regulations.
Think about it. It's the 1820s. The U.S. is still kind of, like, finding its feet after the Constitution, and states are really fiercely protective of what they have, you know.
Especially when it comes to something as delicious as oysters, right?
Absolutely. So in this case, we have New Jersey, and they're, you know, prized oyster beds. And they go and pass a law saying that only New Jersey residents can harvest these tasty bivalves. And then enter Mr. Corfield, a non-resident whose boat, the Hiram, gets confiscated for, well, you know, oyster poaching.
So basically, he was caught red-handed.
Red-handed, or should we say oyster-handed.
Uh-huh, yeah. So what happens next?
Well, Corfield, understandably upset about losing his boat and his, you know, his catch, decides to fight back. He takes his case all the way to the Supreme Court, arguing that this law violates his rights as a U.S. citizen.
Okay, so this is where it gets interesting. What was his legal strategy?
Well, he had kind of like a two-pronged approach. First, he invoked the Privileges and Immunities Clause of Article 4 of the Constitution. And this clause basically aims to ensure that citizens of each state are entitled to the same privileges and immunities as citizens in other states.
So he's saying, hey, I'm a U.S. citizen. I should be able to harvest oysters in New Jersey, just like anyone who lives there.
Exactly. He argued that being able to harvest oysters should be a fundamental right for all citizens, no matter where they live.
That makes sense. But what about New Jersey's claim that they have the right to control their own resources? How did the court address that?
Well, the Supreme Court, and this is interesting, it was led by Justice Bushrod Washington. That's George Washington's nephew. By the way, they had to grapple with this really tough question. Are oysters a fundamental right for all citizens? Or can a state prioritize its own residents?
What a dilemma. On one hand, you have this idea of shared rights for all citizens, and then on the other, you have this idea of states' rights to govern their own affairs, especially when it comes to resources like this.
You've hit the nail on the head. It's this tension, right? And Justice Washington, he delivers a decision that's pretty nuanced. It tries to balance these competing interests. He says, okay, yes, there are fundamental rights that all citizens have, things like the right to travel freely between states, to access the courts, to, you know, engage in commerce in other states.
So basically, rights that ensure a citizen can participate in the civic and economic life of the nation, regardless of which state they're in.
Exactly. But then he distinguishes these fundamental rights from the right to harvest oysters in a specific state's waters. He argues that states DO have the right to manage their natural resources. And yes, they can even prioritize their residents when it comes to those resources.
Okay, that's interesting. So the court is saying that, yes, the Constitution aims to create this unified nation with shared rights. But it also recognizes the power of individual states to manage their own affairs, especially when it comes to things like natural resources.
You got it. And this distinction that Justice Washington makes between these fundamental rights for everyone and rights that states can regulate, it becomes like a cornerstone of American legal thought. And the implications go way beyond oysters. But before we get into the lasting legacy of this case, let's talk about Corfield's other legal argument.
Oh, there's more. He had another trick up his sleeve.
He did. Remember, Corfield, he's a pretty savvy legal strategist. He doesn't just rely on that privileges and immunities argument. He also brings up the Commerce Clause.
Ah, the Commerce Clause. That clause that gives Congress the power to regulate commerce among the states. I'm sensing he was trying to argue that New Jersey's law was interfering with interstate commerce.
You are right on the money. Corfield argued that since he intended to sell the oysters he harvested, you know, in other states, this New Jersey law was getting in the way of interstate commerce. And because the regulation of interstate commerce is a federal thing, he claimed the New Jersey law should be struck down.
That's pretty clever. He's basically saying, look, I'm not just harvesting oysters for myself. I'm engaging in commerce, and that's a federal matter.
Exactly. But the court, they cleverly sidestep this argument. They draw a distinction between harvesting, which they say is a state-regulated activity, and the actual trade or commerce of those oysters, which falls under federal regulation.
So New Jersey can regulate how oysters are gathered within its waters, but once those oysters are shipped off to other states, then the federal government steps in. Seems like they're really trying to draw a clear line between state and federal authority here.
That's exactly what they're doing. And this distinction is going to become super important in later legal battles over things like environmental regulations, where states often try to regulate activities within their borders, even if they might have, you know, broader economic impacts.
I see where you're going with this. It's like the court is saying, states, you have power over what happens within your borders, but once those actions start impacting interstate commerce, then it's a federal issue.
Precisely. And this distinction, even though it's rooted in this, you know, seemingly simple case about oysters, sets a precedent that we're still seeing today in legal arguments about the reach of the Commerce Clause.
Wow. So Corfield v. Coryell is a lot more than just a quirky case about shellfish. It sets the stage for some pretty big questions about state versus federal power that are still relevant today.
Absolutely. And there's even more to it. This case has more twists and turns, including an attempt by Corfield to argue that federal admiralty law should, like, override New Jersey's oyster regulations.
Admiralty law. Now we're talking pirates in the high seas. I'm intrigued. Tell me more about this legal curveball.
Welcome back to our deep dive into Corfield v. Coryell.
Yeah.
Last time we were talking about Corfield's, you know, attempts to use those privileges and immunities and the Commerce Clause arguments, right? And he wasn't successful in overturning that New Jersey oyster law.
Right.
But his arguments, even though he lost, ended up having a pretty big impact on later legal stuff. You know, especially when it comes to that balance of power between the states and the federal government.
Yeah, that's what's so cool about legal history, right? Sometimes a case about something as, I don't know, seemingly small as oysters can actually shape the legal landscape for, like, I don't know, generations to come.
Absolutely. And to really get the lasting legacy of Corfield, we have to kind of, like, trace these threads of its arguments through time, especially when it comes to those two clauses, privileges and immunities and commerce.
Okay, so let's start with the Privileges and Immunities Clause. How did Corfield influence, like, later interpretations of this clause? You know, the one that's supposed to ensure equal treatment for citizens across state lines.
Right. So remember how Justice Washington, in his Corfield decision, had to define what a fundamental right is, you know, a right that all citizens should have, regardless of where they live.
Right. He said things like the right to travel freely between states, to go to court, to engage in commerce. Those were fundamental rights protected by the Privileges and Immunities Clause. But harvesting oysters in a particular state's waters, that wasn't one of them.
Exactly. And this is where it gets really interesting. That list of fundamental rights, the one Justice Washington laid out in Corfield, was later cited in big landmark cases about the 14th Amendment, specifically its own Privileges or Immunities Clause.
Hold on. Are we talking about the 14th Amendment now? The one that was adopted after the Civil War to deal with the citizenship and equal protection. What does an oyster case from 1823 have to do with an amendment that came, like, decades later?
It might seem like a strange connection, I know. But the legal thinking in Corfield actually set the stage for later interpretations of the 14th Amendment. Because, see, the 14th Amendment, it also includes a privileges or immunities clause. And it was meant to stop states from infringing on those fundamental rights of citizens.
So even though Corfield dealt with Article 4's Privileges and Immunities Clause, the reasoning there ended up kind of resonating with those later 14th Amendment interpretations, even though they were about totally different historical stuff.
Exactly. Corfield provided this, like, foundation for later legal arguments about fundamental rights. It shows how powerful legal precedent can be,
mm-hmm.
and how our interpretation of those constitutional principles can change over time.
That's so cool. It's like Justice Washington's words from Corfield were echoing through the decades, shaping legal debates about what rights are truly fundamental for all Americans.
That's a great way to put it. It's like this legal echo that reverberates through American legal history.
Okay, so we've talked about how Corfield influenced privileges and immunities. What about the Commerce Clause? Mm. How did that argument, which, again, Corfield lost in his own case, end up shaping later legal stuff?
Well, Corfield's attempt to use the Commerce Clause, even though it didn't work for him, really foreshadowed this huge legal debate that is still going on today. You know, that tricky question of where state power ends and federal power begins, especially when you have things that seem local but have these wider economic impacts.
It's like, how do you figure out where one person's backyard ends and the shared public space begins? You know, there are always going to be these gray areas about who gets to decide the rules.
Exactly. And the court's decision in Corfield, even though it sided with New Jersey, helped make those boundaries a bit clearer.
Can you give us an example of how Corfield shaped those later Commerce Clause debates? I'm having a little trouble picturing how a fight over oyster harvesting could have such a big impact.
Yeah.
Sure. Think about something like environmental regulations today. Often states will want to put tougher rules on businesses in their state, you know, to protect the environment or people's health. But sometimes those state regulations can impact businesses or whole industries that operate across state lines. And that could mess with interstate commerce.
Oh, I see. So you could have a state that wants to ban some kind of plastic packaging to cut down on pollution. But that ban could impact companies that do business in multiple states.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly you have this clash between a state trying to protect its environment and the potential effect on interstate commerce.
Exactly. And the legal battles that come out of that, they often depend on the Commerce Clause and that question of whether what a state is doing is putting too much of a burden on interstate commerce. And that's where Corfield comes in.
I'm starting to see the connection. So
yeah.
Are you saying that what the court decided in Corfield, where they separated state-regulated harvesting from that federally regulated trade, did that give a framework for thinking about how to balance state and federal power in situations like this?
Yes, you're exactly right. Even though Corfield was about oysters, the court's reasoning about the Commerce Clause had this ripple effect across lots of areas of law, including environmental regulations. It's like Justice Washington, way back in 1823, threw a pebble in a pond, and the ripples are still spreading out, shaping legal interpretations today.
That's such a great image. So Corfield v. Coryell, even though it was about something as, I don't know, basic as oysters, really had a huge impact on how we understand that balance of power in the government and how we regulate activities that go beyond state borders.
You got it. And there's even more. Remember Corfield's attempt to bring up admiralty law?
Oh, right. The admiralty law thing. Remind me, how did that go again?
Well, Corfield tried to argue that because this whole dispute was happening on the water, it should be under the jurisdiction of federal admiralty law, which basically means the law of the sea.
He was like, get this case out of state court and into the federal system.
Exactly. But the Supreme Court didn't buy it. They said that admiralty jurisdiction only applies if Congress has passed specific laws about the issue. And when it came to harvesting oysters, Congress hadn't done that.
So back to state court. It went for Corfield and his oysters.
Yeah, but here's the important part. The court's decision showed that states have a lot of power to regulate what goes on inside their borders, especially when federal law doesn't say anything specific.
It's like the court was saying, hey, states, you've got a lot of freedom to run things as long as you're not messing with federal law.
You got it. And that principle is still super relevant today, you know, in debates about things like education, healthcare, even gun control. It all goes back to that question of how we balance state and federal power in our system.
Wow, we're really seeing the depth of Corfield v. Coryell here. It's not just some, you know, historical curiosity. It's a case that speaks to the very heart of how our government works.
That's right. And it reminds us that sometimes the most important legal principles come from seemingly small disputes. Who knew oysters could help us understand such fundamental questions about our legal system?
Not me, but that's what I love about these deep dives into legal history.
Yeah.
You never know what amazing things you're going to find.
Welcome back. We've been really diving deep into Corfield v. Coryell, a case that's taken us from those oyster beds all the way to the Supreme Court. And we've gone through some, you know, pretty thick legal stuff.
It really is amazing, you know, how this whole dispute about who gets to harvest oysters in New Jersey ended up touching on these really big questions about states' rights, federal power, even what it meant to be a citizen back then in early America.
Yeah, it shows that legal history is, like, full of surprises.
Mm-hmm.
And that cases that seem, I don't know, kind of obscure can actually tell us so much about how our legal system works and how it's evolved over time. Absolutely. So as we wrap up our deep dive into Corfield v. Coryell, I think it's, you know, worth taking a step back and thinking about what this case can teach us today. Like, what can this battle over oysters from way back in the 1820s tell us about the legal and environmental challenges we're facing in the 21st century?
That's what I've been thinking about this whole time. You know, it's great to understand the history and all, but what makes Corfield v. Coryell relevant to us now? What's the takeaway?
Well, I think one of the biggest things Corfield shows us is that states have a really important role when it comes to protecting their own natural resources. Remember how the court said New Jersey was in the right to regulate their oyster beds, even if it meant people from other states couldn't get to them?
Yeah, Justice Washington said states can act as trustees for the environment. like managing those resources to benefit their citizens.
Exactly. And this whole idea of states as trustees, it's still super important for a lot of environmental regulations today. You know, think about things like water rights in the West or trying to protect endangered species. States are often the ones leading the charge.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
But it also seems like there could be, you know, conflict when states are putting their own residents first ahead of the interests of people from other states. How do we make sure those interests are balanced, especially in a country where resources, you know, they often cross state lines?
That's a great question. And it gets right at this ongoing debate about federalism in the U.S. Corfield v. Coryell, it really shows this tension, right? On the one hand, you have this need for everyone to be united and have shared rights. But on the other hand, you have to respect that individual states get to make their own decisions.
Like walking a tightrope.
Yeah. Trying to find that perfect balance between state and federal power. And I think Corfield, while it doesn't give us all the answers, it does give us some clues on how to deal with this balance.
Okay, I'm listening. What kind of insights can we get from this whole oyster story that can help us with these issues today?
Well, one thing Corfield shows us is how important it is to have clear legal distinctions. Remember how the court in Corfield separated that harvesting of oysters, which they said was a local activity states could control, from the actual trade of those oysters between states, which would be federal?
Right. That pre-commercial versus interstate commerce thing.
Yes, exactly. And that idea, you know, even though it was used for oysters in Corfield, it actually has a lot of implications for how we think about all sorts of issues today. Everything from those environmental regulations to, you know, even labor laws.
Can you give me an example of how that would like play out in a more modern situation?
Sure. Imagine a state wants to put in place tougher environmental rules for a certain industry that's operating within that state. Seems like a state issue, right?
Mm-hmm.
But what if that industry, what if it makes products that are shipped and sold all over the country? Does the state's regulation then start to interfere with interstate commerce? And could that mean the federal government needs to get involved?
Okay, I see what you're saying. They can get pretty complicated.
It can. And a lot of the legal battles that happen, they really come down to the Commerce Clause and this question of where state power stops and federal power begins. Yeah, and that's where that precedent set by Corfield, even though it's almost 200 years old, can still be helpful. It reminds us that having clear legal definitions and distinctions, those are super important for figuring out these complex questions about, you know, who has the power to do what in our system.
That's really interesting. The Corfield is reminding us that even though things have changed a lot since the 1820s, those questions about how we balance state and federal power, they're still so important.
Exactly. And here's another thing. Legal precedents, they can be helpful, but they aren't set in stone. How we interpret the Commerce Clause, for example, has changed a lot since 1823. Think about cases like Gibbons v. Ogden or those New Deal cases later on that gave Congress much more power to regulate activities that affect interstate commerce.
So we shouldn't just take the Corfield decision and like automatically apply it to today's world without thinking about how those legal interpretations have shifted over time.
Right. The legal landscape is always changing. How we understand things like interstate commerce, that's constantly being refined. But those core ideas in Corfield, you know, states as trustees, that balance between state and federal power, the need to define what can be regulated really clearly, all of that is still important today.
It's amazing how a case about oysters from way back then can still give us such valuable lessons for all the complexities we face today.
It really shows the power of legal precedent and how these seemingly small cases can have impacts that go way beyond their original context. That's why it's so important to learn about legal history. It helps us understand where we've come from and maybe even where we're going.
So well said. Okay, as we wrap up this deep dive into Corfield v. Coryell, what's the main takeaway for our listeners? What should they be thinking about as they deal with, you know, all the legal and environmental issues of our time?
I think the biggest takeaway is this. Corfield v. Coryell shows us that even little legal fights can have huge consequences. It makes us think critically about that balance between individual rights and protecting things we all share. It helps us appreciate the nuances of how our federal system works. And it reminds us that those legal precedents, they aren't fixed. They're part of a conversation that's always happening about how we govern ourselves.
That's a perfect way to put it. It reminds us that even a case about oysters can teach us so much about these really important challenges and opportunities we have in American law. So until next time, keep on learning, stay curious, and remember, The law is never JSD about the law. It's about people, it's about resources, and it's about that delicate balance that's going to shape all of our futures.